reading service. And we're going to, for the next half hour or so, I'll be reading to you from the Boys Life magazine. A reminder that this content of this program is intended for print and visually impaired audience. Our first article is from Smooth Sailing, entitled Smooth Sailing. A group of land-loving scouts from Minnesota is transformed into real water boys after 1 week at Florida's sea base. The scouts of Troop 303 in Chanasson, Minnesota, used to be what sailors would call landlubbers. That is, people unfamiliar with the sea or sailing. That was before sea base. Now you could call them seal lubbers, if there were such a word. No matter how you say it, spending a week sailing the open seas with the Coral Reef Sailing Program at the BSA's Florida National High Adventure Sea Base will make a sailor out of anybody. During this week of high adventure off the Florida Keys, scouts eat, sleep, and play on a 54-foot vessel. It is truly their home for 5 days. It was an interesting experience, having your house moving all the time, says Mitch Kress, a 15-year-old life scout. It's kind of a different feeling. It's one of the greatest things you can do in scouting. This is not a vacation on a cruise ship. Scouts are expected to do their duties on these ships, including hoisting and lowering the sails, raising and lowering the anchor, cooking, cleaning, and generally keeping all their gear organized. You have to work together, Mitch says. Teamwork is the key. There are just tasks that you have to get done. Just as in real life, once the work is done, it's time to play. Coral Reef Sailing Adventures can choose to emphasize any of a variety of activities. There's no destination. The vessels more or less go where the breeze takes them. High adventure at sea. Some scouts come to sea base to go fishing or to learn to scuba dive. Itineraries are flexible and can change, literally with the wind. Troop 303 came to sail and snorkel. Some of the scouts had sailed on small ships at the lake in their nearby scout camp, but none of them had experienced anything like this. In addition to the Coral Reef Sailing Adventure, Florida's sea base also offers tall ship sailing, an adventure in the Bahamas, sea kayaking, a camping experience on a remote island, and scuba adventure programs. Most itineraries can be tweaked to suit the interests of each crew and include activities such as snorkeling, swimming, and fishing. Participants must be 14 years old by September 1st of the year they plan on attending. It's a lot of work to hoist a sail, says Ben Vanderbroek, a 15-year-old life scout. It's a lot bigger than it looks from a distance. It took about 3 people for us to do it. With the sail raised, the crew headed to a snorkeling hot spot chosen by the captain of the vessel. With names like Alligator Reef and Indian Key, how can you go wrong? Armed only with masks, snorkels, fins, and life jackets, the scouts poured into Florida Bay in search of underwater adventure. It was amazing, says 15-year-old Star Scout David Homestead, just seeing all the wildlife down there and being right there with them. Snorkeling is one of those activities that's hard to describe to anyone who hasn't done it. Trust us on this. If you've only swum around the surface of a pool or lake with a mask on, you might kind of get the idea. But you haven't truly snorkeled until you've snorkeled in the ocean. It's definitely much brighter and more colorful, Mitch says. There's tons more life. Lots of work, lots of play. Another sign the scouts weren't in Minnesota anymore, seasickness. Nearly everyone got queasy, and some even threw up. We won't name names. Nothing a little motion sickness medicine couldn't cure. Everybody took their pills, Ben says. They helped a lot. You also had to stay hydrated. Daytime temperatures there creep into the 90s. It's hot and sunny almost all day, every day. That's a good thing for sailing, but it also requires you to drink more water. And don't forget the sunscreen. My entire back got sunburned the first day, Mitch says. It made sleeping really hard. Most participants choose to sleep outside on the deck of the boat. The hard plastic surface isn't so bad when you throw a few blankets down. Maybe I tired myself out enough during the day that it was easy to sleep, says Ben. You could hear the waves crashing against the side of the boat. The boat was rocking back and forth a little bit, and you could see the stars really well. But they can't get too comfy. Two scouts at a time are required to stand watch in two-hour shifts throughout the night to make sure their anchored vessel doesn't begin to drift away and to make sure other vessels don't drift too close. When they weren't sleeping or snorkeling, the scouts from Troop 303 were planning their next meal or learning the ropes on the massive sailboat. They learned the same navigation skills the captain used to plot their next course, and some even got to steer the vessel. By the end of the trip, the guide didn't need any instruction. Everyone worked together as a team, and it was smooth sailing, literally, from there to the end. Not a bad bunch of landlubbers from Minnesota. Our next article, entitled Less Shoe, More Fun. And there's a few pictures here with a couple of gentlemen, a couple of scouts with their kayaking gear on, along with a kayak on their back. Let's find out what that's all about. Sometimes hiking boots are overkill. Check out these sports sandals and light hikers. Imagine strapping a 45-pound kayak plus camping gear and 6 days' worth of food crammed inside your back. Now carry it for 12 miles up and over a 12,000-foot-high mountain pass. That's exactly what professional kayaker Pat Keller did just so he could paddle a 31-mile stretch to the remote Middle Kings River in California, some of the most difficult white water in the United States. He did it all, hiking and paddling and wearing a pair of river shoes. Pat knows better than most that sometimes it's best to leave the burly hiking boots at home. That's why we asked him to tell us how to shop for sports sandals and light hikers. The lowdown, sandals versus light hikers. There's a place and time for boots, but in some situations, boots can be overkill, like when you're hiking with the day pack or lightweight pack or doing water-based sports in which your feet will be wet much of the time. Rarely do I feel the need to strap on big burly boots, Keller says. If you want freedom and don't want to worry about getting wet crossing creeks, sandals are a great option. Most of the rest of the time, shoes are a better idea. The price. Sports sandals are not cheap. It's difficult to find a quality pair of sandals capable of hiking for less than $70, and most cost more than $100. Though sandals require less material to build, it seems you get more for your money with a pair of light hikers, which run from $75 to $140. For better prices, check the internet for closeouts and the bargain table at your local outfitter shop. Try before you buy. How many times have you heard the gear guy say this? But it's so important. Go to a store where you can try on the sandals or shoes. Bring the sort of socks you'd expect to wear with light hikers. Try on as many as you can, and don't be afraid to tromp all around the store for 10 minutes or so. A lot of fitting shops have a little incline. Try walking down on that, and pay attention for any slipping and potential for blisters, Keller recommends. The right shoe should be comfy from the get-go. With sandals and light hikers, there should be zero break-in period. Be a sole man. Arguably, the most important part of the shoe is the sole, the bottom where all the tread is. The deeper the tread, the more grip you have. You need to trust that those knobbies will get you to the top of the hill, Keller says. And you want to be able to have enough rigidity in the sole that you can kick it into the hillside for traction. Certain types of soles are made for specific activities. Make sure the pair you pick fits with the activities you plan on doing. Harder rubber compounds are better for kicking in steps on steep banks and travel on dirt trails, he says, and they last longer than the squishy, sticky rubber soles that are super good for wet rock, weather or not. Sports sandals are best for wet environments, and they can be good for warm climates too, but some offer more ventilation than others. The same goes for light hikers. Most are constructed with mesh, best for warmer climates, or leather uppers, cooler climates, while some are made with waterproof, breathable fabrics like Gore-Tex. Keep this in mind. Even though the shoe might be waterproof, if you step in a puddle or stream more than ankle deep, your foot will get wet all the same. Fit before fashion. Get what you like, what you think looks good, Keller says, but stop yourself before you buy to make sure it feels good and really fits. Now there's what's hot. Well, here's some ideas. Here are Gear Guy's 10 smart sandal and light hiker picks. The Teva Tanzel, $70, a classic river guide type sandal. The Tanza has straps with 3 points of adjustment so you can get a snug fit, and the straps are backed with neoprene foam for zero hot spots on your feet. Finally, the soles are made with Teva's super sticky spider rubber for good traction in wet conditions. Sports sandals. Cresta sandal. The Kastashi is probably the most techie sandal here. It uses the boa lacing system and steel cable laces and a dial you turn to tighten the fit. You get a more uniform tightness than with regular shoelaces or buckles. This sandal also has a full toe cap and more coverage in the upper than some of the others shown. Then there's the North Face Assailant, $80. This hiking shoe has an upper made of mesh and suede with a lightweight but durable Vibram sole. For $20 more, you can get the Assailant in a waterproof, breathable Gore-Tex version. And last, the Scarpa Epic. Though the Epic was built atop a trail running chassis, this shoe is designed for off-trail scrambling and hiking with a pack. Plus, the sole has slightly stickier rubber than most, which makes it great for rocky terrain. So that's the gear if you plan on doing some hiking. Next article, entitled Finding Their Way, this has a picture of a young man sitting on a limb with purple trousers, and then another picture of another gentleman running through the woods. Let's find out. California scouts put their best orienteering foot forward with a little help from some champs. Orienteering isn't for wimps. Courses can be loaded with tough obstacles, steep hills, deep gullies, even uneven terrain, prickly branches, poison oak, cold wind, and cows. That's what the guys from Troop 109 of Menlo Park, California, encountered at the Bay Area Scout of Orienteering, Scout-O, Championships in October. Held at Briones Regional Park in Martinez, California, the competition involved about 35 BSA units. There was a thistle attack, Star Scout Daniel Kopisch says, and then there was the cows. I got 1 foot away and they wouldn't move. I didn't know if they were going to attack. Fortunately, they weren't attacking cattle. Champ hold. Also, fortunately, Troop 109 had the Corpus brothers on their side. Twins Daniel and Philip, 15, are national champions at orienteering, a sport that is like cross-country running except there is no marked course to follow. The Corpus brothers are a really big help. First-class scout Kendall Lee says, 12, before events, we go out on courses, and they help us learn how to use a compass, orient a map, and know what to look for. Any expert help you can get with the challenge of orienteering is a big plus. It isn't easy to use a compass and map to quickly navigate through terrain from control point to control point. It takes sharp mental skills and physical strength and speed. If you're good at math and puzzle solving, you can be good at orienteering, Daniel says. Cross-country is also a good foundation, Philip adds. Scout, oh, we go. The Bay Area Scout-O meet included two events. In the morning event, scouts competed in pairs on three courses with different levels of difficulty. On the advanced course, which the Kopisch brothers did, participants competed individually. After a staggered start, each pair or individual visited control points along their course in a designated order. And this was 21st century orienteering. Instead of punching a card, competitors carried small devices called e-sticks that they inserted in an electronic box at each control. This electronic punch recorded the control number and time of visit in each e-stick. Turns out there were lots of challenges for Troop 109. A tree had fallen across the trail, and we had to climb through it. First-class scout Jonathan Adams, 14, says, we came close to getting lost, but didn't. We took shortcuts and got lost at two control, Star Scout Taylor Tam, 14, admits, the biggest obstacle to me was the weather. It's pretty cold. I got hit about 12 times running through those spiky plants, Star Scout Matt Tinio, 14, says. Obstacles or not, Troop 109 prevailed. They won the troop competition with the most course points. Plus, Jonathan Adams and Thatcher Freeman, 11, placed third as a team on course two. Not too shabby for having to tackle that fallen tree. In the afternoon, Score-O events, individuals raced to as many controls as possible in 75 minutes. The controls are worth different amounts of points, depending on their difficulty. Competitors can hit the controls in any order, and the guy with the most points wins. Before gathering for the mass start, Troop 109 strategizes with the course map. Find a good route, Philip says. Also, keep an eye on the time so you have enough time to get back to the finish. Good advice. There's a point penalty for each minute over. The scouts set their watch alarm for 50 minutes so they can get back in time for any point on the course. Then they're off. Both Koppish brothers hit all the controls, with Philip finishing with 27 minutes left and Daniel with 25. Combining these scores with their morning scores, Daniel is declared the 2009 Bay Area Scout Orienteering Champ. It's his turn. Philip was the 2008 champ. As a bonus, their dad, Manfred, won the day's adult competition. Troop 109 won't soon forget the day's challenges. I don't even try to take the prickles off my shoes, Daniel says. They're everywhere. I just keep them as souvenirs. And the guys are glad to come in from the cold. As Tenderfoot Scout Ben Leonard 12 puts it, now it's time to defrost. And then has pictures of the Koppish brothers. Let's find out a little bit about them. The Koppish brothers file. Birth date, September 18, 1994. Hometown, Menlo Park, California. Scout rank, Star Scout. Besides orienteering and cross-country running, Daniel enjoys anything outdoors, the guitar, track, and Philip, backpacking, camping, fly fishing, and tying. He started orienteering when we were in diapers, Daniel says. Dad put us in strollers to go out. Their first wins, Daniel won the Bay Area Orienteering Club Championships at age 10 and Philip at 11. The orienteering competition highlights, 2009 U.S. Orienteering Championships, Philip placed second and Daniel third in their age category. And in 2009 U.S. Interscholastic Orienteering Championships at West Point, team placed third out of 60. In 2008 U.S. Orienteering Championships, Daniel placed first and Philip third in their age category. And in 2007 U.S. Ski Orienteering Championships, Philip placed first and Daniel second in their age category. Now, weird bonus. The guys have a collection of antlers from different courses. I've even found antlers attached to a skull, Philip says. Next article is entitled Rebuilding Years. Has a picture of some hikers here, some scouts, digging in the dirt, using a little hoe. And another one standing up in a nice yellow suit and jacket, and he's collecting what is being dug up. Forest fires aren't always bad. Prescribed burns are planned and conducted by forest managers to stimulate the growth of desirable vegetation or to eliminate dead plant matter that could eventually provide the fuel for a larger, more dangerous wildfire. Wildfires are the ones that aren't prescribed and aren't as easily controlled. They can damage thousands of acres of forest and even creep into nearby neighborhoods and destroy homes. Super intense wildfires can damage the soil, robbing it of its ability to absorb water. The next time it rains, water instead runs off into rivers and streams and can eventually cause flooding. Forest managers, sometimes with the help of a local Boy Scout troop, try to prevent the spread of wildfires by planting native trees and other plants that serve as a firebreak. This low-fuel vegetation can slow down wildfires and protect nearby communities. Sometimes forest managers will help a forest regrow after a wildfire by simply planting new trees. It's not as easy as planting a flower in a pot of your home. Trees should be planted correctly to increase the chances of them growing into a hardy plant that can maybe even withstand the next fire. 9 out of 10 forest fires are caused by people who are careless. Always practice the leave-no-trace principles for minimizing campfire impacts. Use a camp stove for cooking. If campfires are permitted, use only established fire rings. Keep fires small by using only sticks from the ground that can be broken by hand. Burn all wood to ash, making sure the spot is cold before you leave. Scouts whose troop choose next month's suggested program theme, forestry, will come to understand and appreciate the importance of protecting forests, one of our most valuable natural resources. Article continues, planting the seeds. Whether you do it in a local park or in the middle of a damaged forest, planting a tree is a great way to help the community and the environment. Planting techniques will differ depending on factors such as soil type, slope, the type of tree, and the time of year. But these steps should give you a general idea of what you'll be in for. Talk with forest managers in your area to find out what services they need. 1. Carry a big shovel. In areas such as Pacific Northwest, young trees must be planted in such a way that they can survive in a stressful environment. In kinder, gentler environments, smaller seedlings with small shovels turn out fine. Otherwise, use a large shovel in a large, vigorous seedlings. 2. Crack open a hole in the ground. When dealing with seedlings, don't worry about shoveling out dirt. It takes too much time. Instead, jam the shovel into the ground at an angle, then push the handle away from your body, creating a crack in the ground. 3. Drop the seedling into the hole. Make sure the hole is the right depth. Hole is the right depth. Seedlings planted too deep will struggle, as will those planted too shallow. Talk to a local tree expert about proper planting depth. Other consideration. 4. Remove the shovel and fill the hole. Repeat. Experienced tree planters can plant dozens of seedlings in just an hour or two using this technique. That's how you reseed a forest. Other considerations. Species selection. Choose trees that will do well on your site and meet your objectives. Site prep. Look for an area that is free of weeds. Try to completely eliminate vegetation 3 to 5 feet around the planting spot. Seedling care. If you're planting from seedlings, extremely young trees, try to plant them as soon as you receive them. Keep the roots moist by placing them in a bucket with water or by covering them with wet material. Site maintenance. You might need to return to the site routinely to control weeds. A young seedling can become smothered in competing vegetation if the area isn't maintained properly. The Trail to Eagle. All good Eagle Scout projects start with a good idea, so be prepared. You never know when inspiration will strike. Ideas for, and here's a picture that shows regular Eagle Scouts building homes and just taking care of all working together for the good. Ideas for great Eagle Scout service projects can come just about any time. For Life Scout T.J. Decker of Troop 446 in Scottsdale, Arizona, inspiration arrived a couple of days after he watched the movie Flags of Our Fathers. The film depicts one of the most dramatic moments of World War II. 5 Marines and a Navy sailor raising a U.S. flag on the island of Iwo Jima in the middle of a fierce battle in 1945. By raising the flag, the men showed the U.S. forces finally had taken control of the island in the Pacific Ocean. One of the Marines was Ira Hayes, a Pima Indian who lived most of his life in the Gila River Indian community near T.J.'s hometown before he died in 1955. T.J. was intrigued by his life story. I thought, oh, that's cool. He's from Arizona, he says. T.J. and his dad visited Hayes' hometown nearby Bapchul, Arizona, to learn more about him and to see what kind of memorial was in place, recognizing a need. Once there, T.J. discovered there wasn't any formal recognition for Hayes. The only memento he found was a small display in a library at an elementary school, so he decided to create a more fitting memorial for the real-life hero. T.J. discussed the idea with the principal at the St. Peter Indian Mission School in Bapchul. She loved the idea and asked him to consider doing something with the partially built garden at the school. T.J. decided to finish the garden and make it a memorial to Hayes. He rounded up 53 volunteers, mostly from his scout troop and from his school. They hauled off 80 wheelbarrow loads of rocks, installed an irrigation system, planted rows of vegetables, completed 3 partially constructed walls, and erected a large engraved flagstone monument in tribute to Hayes. The guys wanted to use traditional Pima Indian construction techniques on the walls, so they started by mixing gobs of adobe, which is made of dirt, straw, and water. A couple of weeds even got into the mixture, but for adobe, that's okay. When adobe is wet, it looks and feels like mud. The guys caked it onto a framework made of wooden ribs from saguaro cactuses. Then the adobe walls dried and hardened. They painted them with whitewash, a long-term memorial. Months before the work began, TJ sent 150 letters to parents of scouts and classmates asking for contribution to cover the cost of materials. He figured he needed $800, but people gave him $4,500. "I was just flabbergasted," he says. After finishing the project, he still had $3,800 left over. At first, he didn't know what to do with the money. Then he remembered that the school principal had told him that some families had a hard time paying tuition to the school. TJ knew he could help again. He used the extra money to create a scholarship fund, which he named the Ira Hayes Soaring Eagle Scholarship Fund, to assist needy students. TJ plans to keep the scholarship funding going by asking for new donations annually. "I can see myself as a 30-year-old going back to the mission every year," he says. And the article continues with pictures and little biographies of the different students. Joseph Koenig, Troop 604, Pensacola, Florida. Joseph and his friends replaced mile markers and signs along a trail used by walkers and runners on Naval Air Station in Pensacola. The trail had 10 signs that were supposed to describe different types of nearby trees and shrubs, but some signs were nowhere near the proper plants. Joseph installed new signs and made sure they were near the plants they described. Nicholas Long, 17, Troop 493 of Virginia Beach in Virginia. Nicholas and his volunteers created a large sun clock at his old grade school, Allenton Elementary School, so the students there could learn how time was kept in ancient times. They laid colorful glass mosaic stepped stones in the ground, marking the months and hours. It's a human sundial. When students step on the proper month, their shadows point to the correct time. Nicholas got the plan from Scotland, but he had to plot his sun clock using the exact latitude and longitude coordinates for the school. And now, let's let us to Pedro. Here's one. "Dear Pedro, one of my favorite features is Bible heroes. How did you come up with that idea?" This is Keel Nibiker in Las Vegas, Nevada. "Well, heroes are popular. Keel, A True Story of Scouts in Action, is our most popular feature. The feature is now titled Bible Stories, but the stories feature heroes as part of one big story." Another letter from Moses Gagliardi, Apple Valley, Minnesota. He asked Pedro, "Is there any way that scouts can earn merit badges through you? Also, are the jokes really written by kids, or do you write them?" Pedro says, "They don't offer merit badges for eating or sleeping, Moises, so I can't help you out. Of course, our readers write the jokes. I just hee-haw at them. Send us your best ones at the address below or through boyslife.org. What? Oh, right, boss. You can also find every single merit badge requirement on our website, Moises." Another letter to Pedro from Everett Barton in Valencia, California. "I liked your article on picking the perfect backpack. Carry on, May. I have gone backpacking a couple of times. I had to bring a lot of water. What backpack do you like best?" Pedro answers, "The one I won't have to carry, Everett. I've toted a lot of packs in my day, and now I have to lug around this mailbag." And finally, from Caleb Haynes in Hickory, North Carolina, "Dear Purely Awesome, All-Ruling, Totally Better Than the Boss Pedro, I love the October article, En Garde. I think you could be the boss. So cut yourself some slack and make yourself a mouth-watering tumbleweed taco." And Pedro responds, "If this gets in print, I'll be surprised, Caleb. Alas, I am not the boss. The boss is the boss. He says I'm a second-rate boss who needs to floss. Just gathering moss. I'm such a loss, he needs to toss. Okay, okay, boss man. He's touchy. He says if I quit the stupid rhymes, he'll print this letter. I think I'll go get that taco now. See you next month." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Boys Life. Be sure to listen all the time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it.